From east to west, across Central Africa, a series of coup d'etats have brought military leaders to power. The first of these, Sudan, is now a rolling civil war, which has led to the largest displacement of people in the world today.
The situation in Sudan is catastrophic, the highest displacement situation globally.
And what has the world done? Some nations simply turn their back on the violence, while others seek to exploit the chaos and instability.
And it cannot be ignored by the international community. It's all too easy to look away.
The situation is dire. It's just beyond horrific, and nothing is being done.
I'm Oz Katterjee, and this is Not a Drill. Sudan, Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, Niger, Gabon. Each nation subject to a military coup in the last half a decade. Most of these countries are part of or border the Sahel region. Plagued by the threats of drought, an explosion of Islamist terror groups from Al-Qaeda to ISIS to Boko Haram in Nigeria, all under a cloud of political turmoil. Since the Arab Spring Revolution in Libya in 2011, mercenaries and guns have swept into the region, and governments are struggling to maintain order. After Libya, French forces patrolled Mali and its borders, aiming to defeat an Islamist insurgency, but failed, and were then forced to withdraw from their Malian bases entirely. Into the gap have come Russia and its Africa Corps arm of the Wagner Group. Gulf states, too, have also entered the fray, seeking greater global influence and a stake in the infrastructure and resources of African partners. In today's episode of This Is Not a Drill, we'll ask what has gone wrong for democracy in the region with Dr. Ebenezer Obadare. But first, 1 year into a terrible war which has displaced more than 10 million people, according to the International Organization for Migration, we must keep our eyes on Sudan. After 30 years of dictatorship, under the tyrant Omar al-Bashir, accused of genocide in the Darfur War, widespread protests led to his ousting by the army in 2019, and a civilian-led government was formed. But since then, the situation has grown worse and worse, with the violent break in the uneasy alliance between the army led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary organization led by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, himself promoted by al-Bashir during the Darfur War. Then, in April 15th, 2023, war broke out in the capital Khartoum as the rival generals sought power. To find out what happened and how Sudan became a devastating example of the malign influence of foreign interference in a civil war and the Western impotence in the face of it, I spoke with the writer Dalia Abdelmonem, herself now a refugee from this war. Hello, Dalia. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Hi, Oz. Thank you for having me.
Sudan is one of the biggest global issues happening right now. But because of the war in Ukraine, because of the war in Gaza, it's not getting as much attention. There isn't as much media focus there. There aren't as many journalists on the ground there. Can you give us a background into what's happening for our audience? Because I presume they don't know that much about what's happening in Sudan, and it would be really helpful to give them like a basic overview so then we can go into more finer specific points later on.
Okay, I'll go back a few years. 2019, we had a successful revolution. We overthrew the government of Omar al-Bashir. You know, popular revolution, peaceful, wonderful. We had a civilian interim government in place. When the revolution happened, the collection of civilian and political groups opted to go for a civilian Abdullah Hamdok, who became the Prime Minister of Sudan. And then in 2021, the two general leaders, the leader of the Sudanese army and the leader of the Rapid Support Forces, which was the rebranding of the Janjaweed, who have history way back when in Darfur 20 years ago, they had a coup. They overthrew and arrested the civilian government. And they were partners, you know, they were partners in crime and they were in power. There were discussions and talks that they would move into a framework of to move into democratic civilian government. It was headed and by the quartet made up of the USA, EU, UN. And the problem, the big obstacle was the integration of both armies into one unit. And who would be who would lead this combined force? And most, you know, love affairs, they fell out and they had war. They, you know, 15th of April, we woke up and there was shelling and fighting in the heart of Khartoum, the capital. And it's been a year of nonstop war, highest number of displaced people in the world, looming famine, you know, rape, atrocities, violations, anything you can think of is happening in Sudan right now. It's also become like a proxy war, so to speak, in a way. So many outside actors who've had a hand in what's happening right now. And there's been no coverage. In the initial 2 months, there was a lot of coverage. But then, like you said, Ukraine and Gaza have taken over the media spotlight. And so Sudan has fallen by the side.
So look, I'd really like to dive into the foreign interference properly. But really, I think our audience needs some help and understanding of who these people are, including Omar al-Bashir, Burhan, Hemeti, the RSF. If you could provide us with that, that'd be really useful for our audience, I think.
The Janjaweed were, you know, Arab tribesmen, militia, who were set up by Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan from 1989 and until 2019. He headed the Islamist Party, the National Congress Party. The war was raging in Darfur, and so the Janjaweed were set up like his private army. It was headed by Hemeti, who was a local Darfurian man. Al-Bashir, to pacify him, gave him the largest gold mine in Sudan, and he really strengthened his hold, you know, his position within Darfur. So Darfur is like their stronghold. It's their base. Burhan rose up and became the commanding general of the Sudanese army after the revolution in 2019. And he also has history in Darfur. He fought in Darfur for the army.
I'd like to dig more into who the government are, who the current armed forces of Sudan are, who controls them. Are they widely supported by the Sudanese people? And what were the conditions that led to this ongoing coup attempt, you could call it, by the RSF that began, as you described it?
The army didn't have support post coup, but they have support now because of, you know, given the choice of the RSF or the army, the vast majority of Sudanese are supporting the army because that is our state entity institute. There's no way we can support a paramilitary. But the army never had the support because don't forget, the army has been killing us since independence. You know, whether it was the civil war with southern Sudan, whether it was in Darfur, the Nuba Mountains, the army has never been the Sudanese people's friend. Even when we used to go out in protest after the coup, it was the army who was shooting at us, you know, firing tear gas at us, killing the youth, you know, who were standing up to them and telling them, we don't want you, we want the civilian government. It was, you know, and at the end of the day, it was still the army that instigated the coup that overthrew the Hamdok government. And so what happened was that Hemeti became stronger and stronger as a figure. He became one of the richest men in Sudan. He actually bailed out the Sudanese National Bank. The Janjaweed were then rebranded as the Rapid Support Forces. So they became a legitimate force from being armed militiamen to being a professional army, so to speak, better armed, better equipped, better trained, better paid than the National Army itself.
Yet they kept their Islamist militia roots, effectively.
Of course, both sides have Islamist roots. They've never left. The Islamists never went away. They took a step back, but they were always present. And they were legitimized post the coup. Like, you know, a paramilitary, they were legitimized. Hemeti was treated as an equal to Burhan. it's a power struggle, but at the same time, it's a struggle for the resources, the, you know, everything about Sudan. And it's continuing. It was always brewing in the background, but it just came to full head on April 15th. So it's like the end justify the means. You know, we're supporting the army now, but because they're the lesser of the two evils. But we're supporting them until this war comes to an end. And, you know, then we can move on. You know, it's like baby steps. Right now, the main concern, stop the war, no more RSF.
So what was interesting for me as a journalist who covered the Arab Spring is that Sudan seemed to follow the Arab Spring model. Now, it might have happened 8 years after the first wave of revolutions, but it seemed to be a continuation of the political change and turmoil happening in the entire Middle East, North Africa region. That pattern, which also matches the following counter-revolution backed by outside foreign interference to sort of defeat the democratic progress that revolutionaries managed to achieve in these countries such as Tunisia, Libya, Egypt. Governments were toppled. In the process of trying to replace that toppled government, the democrats and liberals were pushed out through violent coups, counter-revolutions. So Sudan seemed to follow this model. But I don't want to compress Sudan into just being like another failed Arab Spring revolt. What was specific about Sudan which gave the counter-revolutionary forces the upper hand in this struggle?
They're embedded. I mean, we're fighting, as Sudanese, we were up against a 30-year dictatorship. You know, when you look at the case of political Islamists, Sudan was a success case because they were in power for 30 years. So to dislodge them, it wasn't just about removing the figurehead who was Omar al-Bashir and his government. It's also about putting in place the mechanisms that could change the whole system from the ground up. And that's why it took us longer, so to speak, following the Arab Spring. And we were always fighting against a huge, you know, machine that has been so embedded in all aspects of Sudanese society, commercial activity, politics. It's hard to dislodge them. And at the same time, amplifying and strengthening someone like the Janjaweed, a paramilitary militia, putting it on equal footing to the army was one of the biggest disasters any government can do. And that's what happened. And they're very well armed. They have deep resources, deep pockets. And they've been used as to fight for, in other wars, you know, the RSF has fought in Yemen, has fought in Libya, you know, and now they're fighting in Sudan. And they're also supplemented by mercenaries from Chad, from Niger, from Libya, from Yemen. You know, it's just a mashup of so many different nationalities, yet they all fight under one flag, and that's the RSF. It's a big struggle. Even the army is having difficulty in defeating them. You know, you're talking about a state army, state institute, not being able to defeat a paramilitary. And also the Wagner group has also played a big part in Sudan. So it's simple, but it's also very complex at the same time.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones. Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
So I'd like to talk more about the foreign actors that are fueling the violence. We've spoken a lot about Russia on this podcast, not so much about Russia in Africa, but we have mentioned Wagner and their particular role in propping up many of the dictatorships that are controlling large portions of the continent. But the UAE really gets a free pass in the media. They prop up the Assad regime. They've been at the forefront of the normalization process of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. They are supporting their own rival claims in Yemen. They've backed the warlord Khalifa Haftar in Libya. They are also quite deeply involved in Sudanese politics. And again, we often talk about Russia's involvement in the Middle East or Africa. We talk about France's involvement, the US's involvement. The UAE is almost never spoken about. If you could tell us more about the foreign players involved in the conflict, who they're backing, why they're backing that, what you think they're trying to get out of it, and what the result of that backing has been on the impact that has had on the Sudanese people.
The army is being supported by the Egyptians and supposedly now by Iran. So Iran has now gotten back into the picture. And Turkey was also supporting somewhat the army. Russia has been quiet in a way. I think they're preoccupied with what's happening in Ukraine. But the Wagner Group is still very present in Sudan. Prior to the war, there was talk that, you know, Russia was going to build a navy base in the Red Sea. And then the war broke out. And of course, Wagner has always been there. They've been part of the mining. They were getting all the gold as well. But they're now the enemy of the army. When before they were their friends, they're now the enemy because they've definitely aligned themselves with the RSF. And what's happening now, it's been confirmed that there's Ukrainian forces in Sudan fighting with the army against Wagner. There's video evidence and reports out there. But I think the UAE is playing a huge role. I mean, they're supplying arms. They're equipping the RSF. They're giving them resources. This is how close their relationship is. All the businesses owned by Himiti and his brothers, their headquarters are based in Dubai. They've also owned large amounts of land in Sudan. The gold is still being mined in Sudan during this war. And they're not being called out. And none of the traditional superpowers don't seem to have much of a sway on them. Even Saudi Arabia, which traditionally was more of the power regime in the Gulf area, has seemingly taken a step back and allowed the UAE to take over. They're basically gaining access to our resources, to our mining, to our agricultural land.
What would you ask of the international community to try and combat some of this? What would you ask for from the international community?
I've lost faith in the international community because I realize they only...
We all have.
Yeah, they only fight for what they want to fight for. The UAE isn't like Russia. They won't go in and invade a country. They'll go from the back door. They won't go through the front door. They'll go through the back door and they'll cover their tracks so well. It will take forever for you to be able to dig out and confirm with evidence that this is what they're doing. And the UAE is so close in regards to their relations with the likes of the United Kingdom and the EU and the US. And the fact that some congressmen wrote a public letter, an open letter, calling out the UAE was huge. I mean, even the UN called out the UAE, you know. But there was no coverage of it. It was very small, you know. Even the media don't want to cover it. And those who dare to speak up are silenced.
Well, I can assure you that we hope if you're, you know, part of the media, you have influence there, you might want to listen to this and try and focus more of your coverage on this issue because it's not getting any coverage at the moment. Now, I don't think many people will have looked at a map of Sudan recently and looked at who controls which parts of Sudan. The war is not going amazing for the RSF. Let's be fair. It's not going amazing for the government either. So there's kind of been a stalemate for a while. Yeah, can you give us an overview of where the war is today and where you think it's going to end up?
Basically, there's fighting in like five states in Sudan. And like you said, there's pretty much a stalemate. But what's happening now is that the longer this conflict continues, the worse the humanitarian situation is. This is the issue. Nothing is being done. There's no funding coming through. And the war, I don't know whether they're planning something, what are they going to do? I know the RSF has lost a lot of men. And they're now forcibly conscripting Sudanese males. And the army has gained an uplift by getting a lot of weaponry from Iran, from Turkey. The drones have really done their work because the army depends on aerial bombardment. And that's so indiscriminate. So the civilians are the ones who are paying the price, you know. There's not full-out war, but there's like pockets of fighting. And these pockets of fighting are really deadly. I'm a bit worried because it's been quiet for a while now, for like a month or so. So it's like the calm before the storm.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season five.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcast.
Once again, we are gathered here to address present developments in our sub-regions surrounding the peace and security, as well as the political situation in the Republic of Niger, Burkina Faso, Guinea. We must approach these issues with a sense of unity and commitment to the well-being of our people.
Sudan, of course, is sadly just one example of the violence sweeping across Central Africa. But are there unique links between these coups? Of course, with a past beset by colonialism, across much of Africa, the modern democratic process is in its infancy. But can anything be done to stop the rise of military interventions and bolster peace in the region? From Washington, here's Dr. Ebenezer Obodare, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ebenezer, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, my friend.
Yeah, my pleasure. So look, we've got so much to talk about here. I'm just wondering where the right place to start is. I suppose we should start really with the headline news of the coups happening across Central and West Africa. The question I suppose I'll pose is, look, I know each place is going to have its own regional, social, cultural, political dynamics, but is there a thread that links these situations happening, and what can sort of foreign policy thinkers take away from developments and trying to understand the situation currently unfolding in these regions?
Yeah, it's a good place to start. And I think there is maybe more than a single thread. Maybe we can think of two. So the first one, the obvious one, is that you're talking about countries that have been struggling to remain coherent as a single national unit. Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Chad, and maybe Gabon is an exception in that regard, but I will also put it in the mix. And that seems to be something that is common to all these countries. You know, you're dealing with, many of them are dealing with an Islamic insurgency. So there's that, the sense of an external threat against the coherence of the state. One outcome of that has been a weakening of state capacity, a widening of the distrust between the elite and the common people, which has then opened up the gap for military intervention. So that's one thread that seems to be common to all of them. But the other one, and I did make a mention of this in the piece I did for the Wall Street Journal, is the element of what you might call democratic disgruntlement. The fact that most young people do not see the benefits of having a democratic system. What they see is an elite that is deeply entrenched and that looks out only for itself. They see leaders who don't care about the people. So this is why young people, when they take to the street, it's not as if they love the military. But the essential point they are making, which I think is worth taking on board, is this. That as far as we are concerned, in terms of the everyday effects on our material situation, can I get a job? Can I send my kids to school? Is there a future for me in my particular corner of the world? There is no real difference between a ruler in khaki and a ruler in civilian clothing. And I guess from a foreign policy point of view, you sort of worry about the general stability in these countries, and you worry about how the situation in these countries has opened up the space for different agents and external actors to intervene. So as you and I are speaking now, the Russians are in Mali, you know, I think they're in Burkina Faso, they're trying to open the door in Niger. All of these things are happening against the backdrop of these two cross currents that I've just tried to, you know, to elaborate.
So I want to go into the foreign interference in more detail, but one of the articles I read that you wrote was entitled The False Promise of Afro-Democracy, and I just wanted to get your perspective as to why, as you say, even the perception from young people that they don't see any kind of benefit to their lives from democracy. Why do you think that is?
So you can answer the question in two ways. Let me deal with the part that I think is not specific to Africa. And I think this is perhaps the more important point, which is everywhere you look, citizens are disaffected about democratic outcomes. If you look at the United States, for instance, I mean, there's a lot of just agonizing out there. And people are expressing the sentiment that something is not right about the system. And that thing that is not right, or those things that are not right, need to be fixed. The UK is the same thing. You know, the rise of authoritarian leaders in places like Hungary and Austria. So there's a sense in which you can talk about pressure on liberal democracy to prove itself. And it's one of the reasons why you see this increasing turn toward autocracy, or at least toward an embrace of charismatic leaders who are promising heaven on earth. What you find in Africa, and this is where we get to the specific thing, is the same thing. In a place like South Africa, for example, just to go out of, you know, Central West Africa, unemployment among young people is approaching 50%. The specific thing, and you know, the reason why I wrote that piece is, so if you look at Austria, for instance, nobody is saying we need Austrian democracy. You know, in the US, they're not saying we need American democracy. In the UK, they're not saying, oh, we need UK democracy. They're saying we need to deepen the democratic system. We need more democracy. It's why I got really worried about the emphasis on African, Afro-democracy, African democracy. You think that there's something there that is quintessentially African. I don't think there is such a thing. When you say, oh, we need to go back to an African democracy that is somehow epistemologically different from democracy as we know it, I ask you to show your hands. And I was sort of trying to throw down the gauntlet to those people, you know, making that claim to say, look, the point is to then look for fixes and solutions out of the democratic heritage.
I'm a Middle East focused reporter most of my career. And this is something that always particularly bothered me in some of the narrative in the Western media, particularly in the Arab Spring, the fall of certain regimes in the Middle East being replaced by, you know, rebel organizations that effectively tried to democratize and become civilian overnight. Problem was, people point to these issues, places where things haven't gone well, and said, well, look, this democracy has failed there. And it's like, well, that's one way of looking at it. The other is the institutions that these countries that are founded on, these kinds of things that exist and have existed for potentially hundreds of years in some of these countries we're talking about, these institutions don't spring up overnight. So what's your perspective on the institutional side of things that's happening in many of these countries? And what can we do to try and strengthen the independence of these institutions, particularly like the human rights side of things in some of these countries that have been going through this political turmoil?
The way to think about this is to think about the democratic process in terms of what you might call the software of it and the hardware of it. The software is all these institutions that, you know, what you're talking about, the judiciary, the executive, the legislature, a free press, a free people, a free economy, and the interlocking practices, you know, among them, and the way in which those practices make all of them robust, self-sustaining, even mutually antagonistic at the same time. So that's there. But the hardware, right, is the sensibility, you know, the mentality. And in every successful liberal democracy, what you find is a sort of equilibrium between the two, where those institutions draw on the reservoir of the mentality, the sensibility. It's intangible, but it's always there. Part of the problem you have with, for instance, many African countries is that there hasn't been enough time for many of these countries to sort of experience the pain of birth, you know, the disappointment of building an institution and seeing it crumble, and then try, you know, again and again until 3, 4, 5, 6 generations deep, everybody can sort of say, okay, I think we have something going here. Just think about Nigeria. Nigeria has run a liberal democratic system of some sort now since 1999. And the last election we had last year, the 7th election, presidential election, was the first time that no soldier was running for office at the top of the ticket. If you measure progress in those terms, in terms of, you know, the length of time, that's a remarkable success. I know there's something very very bourgeois about it. Like, oh, Ebenezer is saying, well, the fact that, you know, there is no soldier, you know, running for office is progress. Look, people don't have jobs, you know, the people, and I get that. That is true. But the opposite is what you don't want to do, where you think, because we want jobs, we want, you know, good employment, we want all these things, then let's go to the soldiers. It takes time. Norms take a long time to germinate, to grow, to strengthen, and to settle down. And if there's anything I'm going to sort of say to close it, or is to say, look, in the countries where young people are expressing a lot of disgruntlement, yes, they are absolutely right to express disgruntlement, because all you have to do is to look at the situation, the political and economic situation, and the security situation in those countries, and to say, these young people are right. But the right way to deal with that is to say, young people should also buy into the system, run for office. A great example, the 44-year-old Bassirou Faye, who has just become the president of Senegal. I was looking at the picture of him standing next to President Macky Sall, and I was being mischievous. I told a friend, it's as if President Macky Sall is handing over to his son, right? Such is the generational gap between the two of them. Again, that's another indication of success. President Faye is going to face several challenges. He's going to discover so many things that, you know, he really can't conceive now. But that's the way democracies work. It's hard work. It's difficult. But at the end of the day, the joys are surer and more robust than what you get from the temptation of, you know, going the authoritarian way.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could point to other kind of charismatic leaders like Bobby Wine, another figure that's come up through society, but again, these people sometimes, and particularly in Bobby Wine's case, have come up against a system that is not ready for that kind of, these kinds of conversations, these kinds of politicians, this kind of reform. So, and norms, as you say, these take decades, generations to entrench and to become normalized, but authoritarians don't have to worry about any of that. They can entrench their rule very quickly. So look, I wanted to now finish the show talking about some of the foreign interference. And again, There's so much that we could talk about. We could do an entire show about each of these coups and each of these foreign interference actors. But here, you wrote a piece for the Council on Foreign Relations called The New Scramble for Africa. This is an interesting dynamic that I don't really see talked upon. We always see, you know, this is what China's doing, this is what Russia's doing, and these are interesting stories in the Western press, but there isn't so much going into these kind of great power plays going on inside these African states. So I just wondered what your perspective on that is and what you could tell us about that.
I think that you could boil this down to three terms that, you know, people sort of conflate and don't bother to disaggregate. So there is interaction, there is influence, and then there is interference. I think that once a certain group of analysts, when they see a global middle power or an established global power like Russia in an African country, and they look at the power disparity, they immediately jump to the conclusion that Russia is interfering in the affairs of that country. Or if it's the United States is interfering in the affairs of that country. What they omit is the potential and sometimes the reality that it's not always the so-called superpower that is driving the boat or driving the ship. Look at a place like Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger. Something connects all these three Sahelian countries. The leadership in those countries, as it happens, the military leadership in those countries wanted France out of their lives. Like, okay, we're done. We're tired of your constant intrusion in our domestic policy. You promised that you help us combat the Islamic insurgency. None of that has transpired. Please leave us alone. That's a power move, right? France had to comply. But what did these countries then do? They then went and got Russia involved. Russia is giving military support to some of these countries. In Burkina Faso, which is now basically Ouagadougou and just its environs, because the Islamic insurgency has decimated the rest of the country. Russia is helping Burkina Faso, help the regime hold on to the last vestiges of power. When people don't recognize things in this way, they condescend without meaning to. And they omit the very important fact that for the better part of the last 60 years in the post-colonial period, African countries have been the captains of their own ship and the masters of their own fate. The point I was trying to make in that particular piece was to then make, you know, sort of drive home this point and to ask us to pay greater attention to the agency of African countries, and not to assume that because so many countries, Western countries, you know, Middle East countries, you know, Gulf countries, that these countries are increasingly interested in Africa, then means that it is scramble for Africa. So I had a question mark. No, there is no scramble. You scramble for something that is inanimate, agentless. In the latter part of the 19th century, you know, we're talking about, you know, the conference in Berlin and all of that. We didn't have Africa the way we have it now. But once you have this static framework that is not flexible enough to accommodate new data and new development, you are stuck in a conceptual rut. You fail to see all the dynamism and all the ways in which different African countries sometimes are playing the great powers against one another to advance their own interests. In my own book, that is called diplomacy. It is not interference.
But to pick up on that, though the power brokers in each country will make their own decisions, there is clearly much at stake and also much to be gained by foreign actors in terms of their investments in the region and interventions in any crises. But the French, for example, are now no longer welcome in large parts of Central Africa. Is it even more detrimental if Western nations simply turn away?
Yeah, and this is where the earlier question about the progress of democracy in African countries, you know, comes into play. You are absolutely right that there is a threat against the liberal international order, as we've always understood it. And if nobody knew that, it came out most vividly in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when the United States and the Western allies try to corral all the African countries in one direction. And many of them said, no, we're not going to do that. Some of them voted, of course, you know, for the UN resolution. Many abstained, surprisingly. And it was the first moment that in Washington, you know, in London, people thought, okay, there's something out cooking out there, something brewing that we've not paid sufficient attention to. And part of what is going on is a deliberate attempt by Russia, by China, to undermine not just the liberal international order, that is the ultimate goal, but to defame the idea of liberal democracy. So China is building so-called leadership schools, you know, in Africa, where it's trying to train African leaders in the Maoist way. Putin has been out there selling himself as a figure of resistance to the West and confirmation or standing proof that authoritarianism works. This is why it's never been more important to strengthen liberal democracy. The more liberal democracy struggles, the more these malign actors and nefarious agents are able to point attention and say, see, I told you, it doesn't work. I give you something different, charismatic authoritarianism. It works, it's top down, nobody is able to disagree, and it gives you, it puts food on your table, it gives you jobs. It's a false promise, right? Because in many African countries where we've experienced military dictatorship and other forms of authoritarianism, we know that that is the road to slavery, that it does not work. So we have a common interest then in strengthening liberal democracy, not just because we want to repudiate its adversaries outside at the continent, but also because we want to be able to show that the only path to economic prosperity and dignity for Africans is through the ballot, free speech, free press, free economies, and institutions that reflect the wishes of the people at all times.
I'm Oz Katerji, and thanks for listening to this episode of This Is Not a Drill. In light of what we've heard, on many in the West misunderstanding or ignoring such problems, I'll leave the final word to Dalia Abdulmonaim.
If you live in the West, you can access your leader, your political leaders, your parliamentary members, you know, your congressfolk. I don't have that privilege. The only weapon I have is doing these interviews, posting, tweeting, writing. It's the only thing I can do. And trying to amplify Sudanese, you know, the ones who are still in Sudan and helping those. So just raise the alarm on Sudan, because it's 10 million people have been displaced. You know, I'm technically a refugee because I cross borders, but I'm luckier than most, you know, far luckier than most. The situation is dire. It's just beyond horrific. And nothing is being done. It's being ignored and forgotten.
This Is Not a Drill was written and presented by Oz Katerji and produced by Robin Lieber. Art by Jim Parrott and music by Paul Hartman. Group editor is Andrew Harrison and executive producer Martin Boytosh. This Is Not a Drill is a Podmasters production.